This is Take Note. It's a podcast about paying attention and keeping a notebook. I am here with my buddy Ted. Ted, a red fox stain covers Blue Hill. How are you?
I totally agree.
Great. Moving on. on this show, we allude to the skunks we've seen earlier in the night.
We try and get each other.
We try to, well, only one of us is trying to get the other one. The other one, the other one's a professional. So, you know, you guys.
It's a gotcha.
Audience can be the judge. Audience can be the judge. No, I saw a skunk earlier. And so, as we finished our walk at the skunk hour, I read, you know it's a skunk hour when you see a skunk. I started reciting Skunk Hour by Robert Lowell to my wife. Not from memory, exactly. More like from
a
website on my phone.
Yeah. You had a copy of the book.
Yeah,
I
keep Skunk Hour folded in my wallet, but I don't carry my wallet when I walk with my wife at night because she might mug me. Anyways,
yep.
Skunk Hour is a good poem. It's by Robert Lowell. He wrote it for Elizabeth Bishop. What a couple of kooky kids those two were. On this show, we like to talk about what we've written in our notebook recently. Ted, what do you got?
I went to my 12-year-old daughter's middle school reading competition in the middle of the day.
Hold on. Your middle school daughter's reading competition?
It's called Name That Book. They have to read a bunch of books. It's kind of like a little mini game show.
Okay.
They read a bunch of books, and then these teams of middle schoolers compete against other middle schools to name which book a quotation came from. So it's a lot like your Skunk Hour gotcha start to the show.
Where you just your daughter would have had no problem with that, right?
Yeah.
Because she's read the collective poems of Robert Lowell. Yeah.
Yes, correct. So this was, kind of a big deal. They hustle over to an area high school and go to the library where they compete against other teams of middle schoolers. I took a few notes. I could have taken more. But at one point...
What are you going to possibly do with those notes, though, really, if you think about it?
Yeah. If only I'd come up with some way to use notes that I've taken. One middle schooler at some point before the competition started says to her friend, am I walking right? How do you walk? How do you walk?
So Larry David,
this was the librarian's Super Bowl. So the middle school librarian was running the show in this situation. She was the head coach. She was the Newt Rockne, the Nick Saban. She knew every rule back and forth, had a very pleasant demeanor. But the central folks said, all right, there's going to be four rounds. This librarian looked at me. We were just at the same table in the library. Looked at me with piercing eyes and just had this look like, does not compute. And she said, last year we had five rounds. interesting. Which is how a librarian says, I'm about to break somebody's neck. And she said at one point in the course of the conversation, well, I was at a librarian's dinner I thought of you. I thought my friend Adam would love to be at a librarian's dinner. Pretty sure.
I would love to be at a librarian's dinner. Mad respect for most of the librarians at my award-winning library. My personal award-winning library.
I think middle school librarians... Maybe every librarian, every school librarian, possibly keeping the whole country moving forward.
Yeah.
With their collective efforts, certainly on display at the Name That Book competition.
How did the Name That Book competition go?
I think we got fourth place.
Okay.
Could have got a little better. But it's the competition was stiff. Finally, there was a... I think it's the coordinating librarian-esque person. She was a librarian for the whole school district who was running the thing, and it was her and another guy, and the guy sort of took it upon himself to, this was his kind of stand-up comedy.
You know, it's good when
opportunity
when non-professional comedians decide to do an open mic night not at a comedy club. That's great.
Yeah, middle school reading competition. So his job was to say, you know, the quote. So he would read it out loud, the quotation. Buffalo the skunk goes in the road in the middle of the night, Elizabeth, dearest. Mm-hmm. And every time he would say, a name that buh. So it was a name that buh.
That's pretty and then funny, it was, actually.
A name that buh. And, you know. Kind of our Chewbacca. We got the, you know, the Irish washerwoman. This was his time to shine, and he did say, you know, he was holding the mic for the head librarian to talk into, and at one point she was like, kind of millennial LOLing her way through it, and she was like, look, could you hold the mic a little closer, please? Like, come on now, and he said. I am so sorry that I was not the mic stand that you needed to be me to be at this moment. So it was a real,
yeah,
it was a real scene. You know, yeah. Some people have kind of the comedy cellar, like New York in the 80s, or the laugh stop, you know, LA in the 90s. And
give me one more. Let's see. I want to hear you do one more comedy club name.
Oh, and you get the ha-ha hole.
There we go. In Houston. The Houston ha-ha hole.
Crunch.
Yeah,
the Houston ha-ha. And some of us have the name that book competition.
Yeah.
All right, Adam.
I don't think that my son, who loves to read, my middle school-ish, he's not a middle school-age son, could handle the name that book competition because I have inadvertently spent years psyching him out by insisting that his entire class's favorite author is Polish Nobel laureate Olga Tokarczuk. When they say they're starting a new book in school, I ask if it's The Impusium by Olga Tokarczuk. I have destroyed him. And so if he was in that thing, right, and he'd be totally prepped, he's a big reader, and he would know the stuff, he'd be ready for Skunk Hour by Robert Lowell. He wouldn't. Maybe, who knows? He wouldn't, but
possibly
in the back
more
of his head,
think.
In the back of his head, he'd be like,
"Dad's reading his.
Oh, could this be Tokarczuk? Could this one be Tokarczuk? Is it finally gonna? I should have paid attention to all the Tokarczuk talk. Yeah.
When the quotation is bleak and it's a page and a half long sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Tokarczuk I don't know. Time. It's okay. He'll end up being the stand-up comic though, because you know I've scarred him. All right.
All right, what do you got, Adam?
Okay, well, I don't have an obvious haha one. So unfortunately, I need to share with you a sincere and pathetic insight that I scrawled down while maybe half asleep. Here we go.
If you didn't share it here, where would you share it?
Exactly.
Let's go.
Thinking of my balding through the lens of the Japanese art style of appreciating a broken piece of pottery, but can't remember the name of that style. That's what I've written. And I have since figured out the style that I'm thinking of. It's not kintsugi, because if it was kintsugi, we'd be using, gold to cover my bald spot. It's not
That's
that.
That's what I was thinking.
I've figured out what it is. It's funnier, I think, with me not saying it. So that's my what do you got.
Yeah. If as an alternative energy source we could tap into the power required for American people to try and remember the name of that Japanese practice of repairing broken things, I'm saying we could get maybe 11% of our national energy output out of that.
I look at it.
What you're doing is it. Almost a public utility, I would say.
Thank you. Thank you. My car runs on it, actually.
Well,
yeah.
Self-powering.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. What do you got?
I don't know. I don't know if this is going to translate, but I took this note.
Can't be worse than mine.
Okay, I'm just going to read a little bit. As I sat at a light on Holcomb Boulevard on my way to work, a vehicle pulled up next to me. I couldn't tear my eyes away from it. I was, parenthetically, listening to a Bill Murray interview in which a strong theme was staying present, and he set a certain tone. So maybe that had something to do with how it felt to see this vehicle. What the vehicle was as follows. It was a Scion XB, which I had to look up. I didn't know that. Of extreme boxiness, with corners as sharp as those of a slightly used cardboard box. The XB seemed to hover a quarter inch above the asphalt. If I had to put a timeline on this vehicle, I would say it was made in 2004. For some reason, perhaps the angularity of the vehicle, maybe it was the podcast, maybe it was Bill Murray describing his misbehavior on set and his confusion about why things took such a sour turn. I looked over at the Scion XB. A 60-ish Southeast Asian fellow chilled out with me at the light. Nothing out of the ordinary, just a guy driving a remarkable vehicle. The logo, presumably the Scion logo, was long gone, leaving a smeared halo of discolored paint. The license plate hung at a jaunty angle, a smeared slash of paint on the bumper spoke of past encounters with other vehicles, and a baby on board decal on the rear windshield was missing an A and an O. The odds that a baby was on board?
That's beautiful. And Bill Murray helped you get there?
It was all, you know, it was all part of the experience.
New York Times, that podcast, the interview podcast from New York Times?
Yeah, that's the one.
Okay, I didn't listen to it yet. I don't know what to think about Bill Murray anymore.
Well, I mean, come on, you should listen to it. He's great. One thing he said in his defense.
In his defense of what?
Oh, he mishandled somebody.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's not even the concern, right? I think I was a little checked out before that. Nothing, you know, it's just at some point he's too cute, you know?
He is very cute. And, yeah. You know, he was sort of defending himself, and he said something like, I meet so many people. You know, he said to the host, you might meet 100 people. I meet 1,000, and every one of those, I'm paraphrasing, I don't know exactly what he said, but you know, more or less, every one of those interactions has to go great. Like that's what I'm on the hook for, is thousands upon thousands of interactions. It was a little bit of like, what's it like to be, the other thing he said that was funny is like, I'm basically a professional picture taker. Like, I know how to do is take a picture with someone's phone who comes up to me. And I know it. I know how to do it better than you. I know how to work your phone, you turn it at the right angle. And people say, how do you know how to do this? And I say, I do this. This is the thing I do more than any other. So it's worth listening to, because there's a certain strange melancholy. I mean, Lost in Translation continues to seem like a relevant film for his general life, just this surreality of it. It's worth listening to.
Yeah, I should. I mean, I don't know what it's like. It's, you know, I mean, I don't have like a problem with Bill Murray, but I just feel like,
whoa, the way you said that, it made it sound like you like might kind of have a problem with Bill Murray.
You can only be charmed by this thing where like, supposedly he doesn't have a phone and he's impossible to reach. And he like phones it in the new Ghostbusters movie in some weird way, and like he doesn't really want to do the stuff. There's just like, it is genuinely charming for some amount of time, all the Bill Murray stories, the story about, and who knows if it's true, that he like went and like, you know, I don't even know, like walked up to somebody and said, no one's gonna believe this really happened to you, and you know, be like, no one's gonna actually believe this because there's no photo of it. Like, that's all charming, but just at some point Just like he sounds like he's sick of it. I think I've got a right to be tired of it too, you know?
Well, the fact that you remember that anecdote, though, means you need to listen to the podcast because he literally addresses that exact anecdote.
Yeah.
Okay. You're actually the target audience.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah,
He's going to put that anecdote into context for you.
Okay. Yeah, sounds good.
Anyway, I think that was probably part of why, I don't know, that was just the frequency that my brain was on when this seemingly unremarkable vehicle rolled into my life and for some small amount of time seemed to possess a certain aura that, I don't know, maybe this podcast, that's what this podcast is all about, is scions that possess an aura for a brief amount of time and then whiz off down the road, never to be seen again.
Hey, if they will sponsor, I'm fine if that's what this podcast is about.
Do they? I don't know if the company, is the company still solvent?
Dude, I don't think I don't think they existed to begin with. I think the whole thing's a dream.
I think that's part of the beauty of the Scion. Is it even real?
Right. It's like Fresca. Like, when's the last time you've seen a Fresca? It's just we all have memories of Fresca.
Yeah. Like collective Mandela effect. Mm-hmm. Fly-by-night car companies and
I genuinely almost spit my Fresca when you said that.
You got another one or
no, but I got a book in front of me. I just lost one of the pages here. I got a book in front of me that is relevant to our interests in a couple of ways. I think that Elisa Gabbert, you know, might be pronounced Eliza, but it's spelled like Elisa Gabbert. I think she's my favorite essayist. I'm almost finished the second book of essays of hers that I've read. I also read her most recent poetry collection, which is called Skunk Normal Road. Distance. Skunk Road.
Skunk on the Road.
And, you know, Normal Distance, I think if somebody's listening and you don't read poetry, go read Normal Distance by Elisa Gabbert. It's different and compelling. And she was also a poetry columnist for the New York Times, so it's not like it's anti-poetry or anything like that. I think she's my favorite essayist, in part because she often is writing about books and keeping a journal. And so I've got two passages. The first one is less about journals, and the second one is more about journals and diaries. But the first one reflects on a discussion that we had a couple weeks ago about the, like, writing something down to find out what you're thinking. And so I'll just read, you know, I got like a paragraph of it. I encountered Joan Didion's famous line about why she writes, quote, entirely to find out what I'm thinking, unquote, many times before I read the essay it comes from, and was reminded once again to never assume you know what anything means out of context. I'd always thought the line was about her essays, about writing nonfiction to discover her own beliefs. Because, of course, the act of making an argument clear on the page brings clarity to the writer, too. She may have believed that. She may have thought it a truth too obvious to state. In any case, it's not what she meant. She was talking about why she writes fiction. And then it goes on with a quote from Didion. And so that was a wonderful corrective, because I think we both decided to... I kind of sprung one on you, as I always do in this gotcha podcast about how to figure out what I think about something, and we kind of circled that quote, and like everyone else, apparently, we assumed we knew what it meant, and it's actually about fiction, and not even entirely what you're thinking. It's not about piecing an idea together. It's more about finding the words for an image in your head. So I thought that one was worth sharing.
It's an interesting idea that... I mean, I try to think about writing and what it means to write. And I think about this a lot. Like, what is it to read something? And I think a lot of long form reading is this heightened level of concentration on somebody's part to get across whatever the result of the heightened state of concentration on the page is, when you're so zoomed in on a piece of writing that you're just entirely speaking that language, you know what happened four pages prior that brings tension and interest to whatever, to the sentence that you're on, as the kind of unfold, like tension is always the word that comes to mind. Like, what is the tension that the writer has spent this focus and this concentration building up? And that, to me, it's like, you know, the reader is reading and bringing their own stuff to the work, and the writer is writing. But to me, it's like the writer is creating this sustained focus, and the reader is like so engaged with that. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But it does. I mean, context, to me, context, you know, it's like reading Didion and knowing what she's talking about. Like, she's not writing a short quotation, she's writing a long piece about whatever it is that has its context because she's built up the tension of it over time. You think that relates to what Gabbert is saying?
Well, this essay is like a kind of a beautiful collage of quotes and thoughts about why writers write. Like, literally why I write. From a bunch of why I write type essays. But, no, I mean, I think what she's saying is she's kind of picking at the ideas of why writers write by looking at their quotes and sort of finding what lines up for her and finding interesting overlaps. I think the interesting thing about the Didion quote, and that Faulkner has the same sort of reason too, and she links a few others to it, DeLillo, and then she goes in different directions. So it's not like this is the answer, but it's an overlap for them, is the finding the vocabulary for an image, which does not necessarily mean, in Didion's case, it's figuring out how to describe an image. It's more, it can mean that, but it's more, a number of authors seem to start, DeLillo, Nabokov maybe not an image, but DeLillo, Faulkner, Didion, they start with their fiction, with an image in their head. And then it's just, you know, she writes to find out what she's thinking. It's what she's thinking about that image. And like that image, that, geez, and in one of, maybe later in this essay, Gabbert thinks of it as like the first idea is a seed, and Gabbert thinks of it as a house you build around that seed. That could be from a different essay. That's how Gabbert thinks of it. But it is, it's finding the vocabulary for the ideas when the entire bit of fiction starts from an image, which I thought was interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah, and then in a pretty different, in a different essay, a different idea, this one about journals, I'm going to quote two quotes about diaries. So this will be, I don't know, this is about the same length. In his preface to A Writer's Diary, the volume of extracts from Virginia Woolf's diaries he edited, Leonard Woolf remarks that, even taken in full, diaries give a distorted or one-sided portrait because one gets into the habit of recording one particular kind of mood, irritation, or misery, say, and not writing one's diary when one is feeling the opposite. Max Brod writes something similar in his postscript to Kafka's diaries, which he published against his friend's wish that they be burned unread. Quote, one must in general take into consideration the false impression that every diary unintentionally makes. When you keep a diary, you usually put down only what is oppressive or irritating. By being put down on paper, painful impressions are got rid of. And I thought that was wonderful. And then goes on with other similar, with Sontag, similar quotes about Sontag's diaries. And I don't necessarily use my notebook that way anymore. I use my notebook to collect things for the most part that make me very happy, or just little minutiae things like the Scion. That's the sort of thing that I would like to write down as well. Yeah. But I used to write that way. Like, I used to use my notebook more like a diary as a way of working out these oppressive things, getting it down on paper. And, you know, I'd love to say that I'm doing it right and Kafka was doing it wrong. But I don't really think that, you know, the long view of history is going to agree with that.
Yeah, sure. I've never felt that way about a diary, like, you know, confessional. But obviously that's the stereotype. But I think the way people write in their diaries probably as variable as personalities themselves. And I think, listen, if you're not burning your diaries yourself, you're not serious.
Yeah, that's right. Like, that's right. Because
please, after I go, you must destroy these. But for now, they will. These 150 diaries taking up space. No, I couldn't do it myself. But come on, guy.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm guilty of that. Like, I think my early diaries, like, just trying to work out when I was, like, a very new father and some of, like, the feelings with that and, like, that the idea that my kids would, like, see the frustration. It's exactly that idea, that those frustrations would appear like they were the real picture is, like, horrifying to me. We've said this before, probably years ago I've said this on the show. I never did anything about it, you know? They're all still there in a box, like just waiting, like a little ticking time bomb if I'm so convinced that it's going to be horrible, you know? You're right. I mean, Kafka should have burnt him himself. That's a very good point. Yeah.
Dear diary, I keep carrying around this copy of Skunk Road and reading it to my young child. Will this be my entire life? Will one day I leave behind this practice of reading Robert Lowell poems to the people around me at inopportune times?
That's right. I wouldn't read Skunk Hour to my kids, but I am going to read one of my favorite stanzas to you. By the way, Elisa Gabbert mentions that it reminds us that stanza is also the word for room, I think. Yeah. I think I've got that right.
Oh, man.
I'm pretty sure I've got that right.
All right. Read me your skunk poem. Because
this one's just great. This stanza is just wonderful. One dark night, my tutor Ford climbed the hill's skull. I watched for love cars. Lights turned down. They lay together, hull to hull, where the graveyard shelves on the town. My mind's not right.
Love cars?
Love cars.
That's the scion. You just brought this all together. Let's do this again next week, Adam. Let's drive our love cars in tandem down the road of life.
A fresca for both of us, bud.
You can find us on the internet at takenote.space. There you can sign up for our newsletter. Adam's really good at writing newsletters, so I suggest that you tune in, tune up, tune out. You can
I think that find was the link fresca theme, or that was the fresca slogan, right?
To our Patreon page, you can support us. Those who do support us, quite amazing. It's a free podcast. It's a labor of love, and you make it a little more lovely. Thank you for that. You can email us at takenotecentral@gmail.com. In the meantime, take care.